Today's presenter is Vanessa Brooks. Vanessa joined the Application Integration Middleware Customer Programs team in 2005. In this role, she helps customers work with early release versions of IBM software products through beta programs, providing migration assistance and in-depth technical training and support during the beta product phase and gathering pre-release customer feedback on IBM products. She specializes in Webster Application Server and IBM's core Java technology. At this time, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Vanessa.
Thank you so much, Elijah. That was a wonderful introduction. I really appreciate that. Yeah, as you said, my name is Vanessa Groves, and I work in the AIM Customer Programs organization. And my involvement with the Java technology was as the technical lead for our Java early release programs that we did for Java version 6. And so I've been working with this product for quite a long time. I've worked with several different customers as they've been adopting Java 6 and moving to Java 6. And as many of you may know, our upcoming release of WebSphere Application Server, which is WebSphere Application Server version 7, is going to be built on top of this IBM SDK for Java 6. So it is a really important technology to us, and it'll be incorporated into just a really broad range of our IBM software products. So it's a great place to start and a great place to sort of understand what's going on in the core of our technologies. So let's move forward to slide 2. So here in our time together this morning, first what I'm going to do is focus on, you know, what's new in Java 6. So my sort of tacit assumption is that most of the people will have sort of a general understanding of, you know, what's a JVM and what are the pieces and sort of how it all fits together. And so I'm really going to be focusing on the things that have changed in version 6. So we'll talk about that in terms of, you know, the class libraries and the overall Java SE specification. And we'll also talk about the runtime components of the IBM SDK, what we do that's unique in the industry to make our SDK sort of stand out from the others. And then after we've talked about the runtime environment, we'll move to look at serviceability components and tools. And some of the serviceability components are things that are built directly into the SDK itself, and some of them are going to be sort of separate standalone tools that can help you as you're working with Java 6 and to diagnose Java problems. So we'll spend a good chunk of our time talking about problem determination and serviceability components and tools. And then finally, to kind of wrap things up, we'll take a quick look at some of the common migration problems that folks see when they're doing migration to the Java SE 6 environment. And that's based largely on things that have changed in the specification level. So we'll be talking about sort of limitations in that change that you might hit. And a lot of that's based on actual things that we have seen customers hit or that we've seen internally here at IBM as we've been migrating our products to the updated SDK level. So our first section, we're going to focus on the runtime environment, and if we can go ahead and move actually to slide 4 is where that content's going to start. And you may notice that as we go through here, there are a couple of slides where the colors maybe look a little funky or some of this stuff doesn't transfer very well to the e-meeting and kind of runs off the screen. And so in those cases, the PDF version of the file that's available does contain the correct-looking information. So this is one of those. And for all that stuff, you can reference the PDF to see the full sort of normal information. So what is in the Java SE 6 specification? You may recall as we moved from Java 1.4.2 to Java 5 that change in the spec level was pretty huge. So we introduced a lot of stuff in Java 5 that were really major features in the language, things like annotations, things like support for generics and strong typing in the Java programming language. So a lot of big, heavy-hitting features, changing really the core of Java programming and the way that you could do Java programming. When Java 5 was sort of announced and released, some said that they had no plans to introduce anything like, a 5.1 or a 5.2 specification level of that JDK release. So lots of people sort of think of Java 6 as more of a point release on top of Java 5, which is kind of a reasonable thing, because if you look at what's actually new in the specification, a lot of it really is just API changes and things like incorporating some of those new features that were introduced in Java 5, like the support for annotations and like the support for generics. A lot of that technology was pulled into the JDK and sort of spread across a bunch of the different APIs that are available in the core Java class libraries. So we don't see those major heavy-hitting language feature changes this release, but we do have a lot of API enhancements. So I want to highlight a few of those for you here on slide 4. The XML stuff is quite important, and web services as well. So the idea with Java 6 is that you have the capability to build a full web services client stack in the SE version of Java. For those of you who work with Java EE stuff, you know that a lot of these things like stacks and XML binding and JaxWS are supported also in Java EE 5. But many of those several of the things that were added in Java EE 5 were also pulled down into the SE version of the Java 6 specification as well. Again, to support things like building that web services client within the SE version of the Java product. Also, a lot of work going on with annotations. So including more core annotations in the base class libraries. And that's in JSR 118, JSR 250. Both of those guys include several new annotations that can be used then across your Java programs. Also, in addition to just the new annotations themselves, there's additional annotation processing capability built into Java 6. The last few JSRs listed here on slide 4 are slightly heavier hitting updates. So JDBC 4, a new version of the JDBC specification. And a lot of focus there is on improving error handling, improving ease of use, improving your speed of development. And a lot of that's happening through annotations that have been incorporated into the JDBC spec. So the idea is that it then becomes easier and faster to create those database connections and to interact with your database. And there's also a lot of good, robust, and simplified error handling that was introduced in JDBC 4 as well. The Java Compiler API is a set of Java APIs that allow you to programmatically invoke a Java compiler from within a Java program. So previously this was somewhat complicated to do and would sometimes require native code implementations. So this is just a really cool thing for particularly tool developers. So if you want a way from within an IDE to be able to call down into that Java compiler and deal with compiler errors or warnings or problems, this API can help you do that. Scripting for the Java platform is, again, a set of APIs to interact with scripting engines from within the Java programming language. So you can do things like, call external scripts, get data back, so share sharing data between your script and your Java environment. So that's available in the Java 6 specification as well. And this last one, the class file spec change, sounds sort of scary, right? Like we're changing the class file format in Java 6. And so So that is kind of a big deal, but for most folks, you won't even notice that that changed. If you do things like develop bytecode instrumentation tools or things that really depend very closely on the class file format, then you need to pay attention to that. But, you know, typically we'll say, you know, any class file that's compiled for Java 142 or for Java 5, if those classes continue to work in the Java 6 JVM. And for most people, that class file spec change really should be transparent. There was a question in the e-meeting chat about WS security and whether that's supported as a part of this group of specifications for Java 6. And the answer to that is no. WS security is not supported in the base JDK, but it would be supported in things like the feature pack for web services that's built on top of WebSphere Application Server version 6.1. And there'll also be WS security support in WAS version 7 as well. So let's go ahead and move forward to Java 5. To slide 5, please. Thanks, Elijah. So XML, a big deal for us, particularly in terms of web services processing. So this Stacks parser is a streaming API for XML, which essentially just provides a really highly performing XML parser that processes XML documents faster than the typical or traditional Stacks and DOM parsers. And this is also really great because it does work in a streaming fashion. So you can begin to pull in and parse your web services messages as they're coming across the pipe. And so this is a cool thing. We do have our own IBM internal implementation of this Stacks parsing technology, which is quite good and performs very well. Similarly with XSLT processing, we've introduced a new XSLT processor in this release, which is called XLTXEJ and replaces the XSLT4J compiler that was used in the previous release. And again, this XSLT processor has some very compelling performance characteristics compared to the previous versions in some operating environments. The thing about this, though, is that any XSLT artifacts that you have do need to be recompiled because those artifacts depend on the underlying libraries that are available. Since this processor has changed, those XSLT artifacts need to be recompiled at the updated level. If we can, move to slide 6. So in addition to the big JSR changes, and we have obviously a huge focus on XML, pulling in annotations, doing web services. There are a lot of other smaller things that were introduced in Java 6 across the board, and one area where several changes did go in, but they don't happen to fall under a particular JSR, is in the area of client programming and dealing with application clients. A few that I want to highlight are the fast splash screens, which is really cool. If you think about a splash screen and kind of what it's for, when you click to open some Java application, or any application that has a splash screen, you really want that screen to show up pretty instantaneously because it gives the user that feedback that, yes, I clicked this, it's working, the program is loading, so that they know that something's happened and they get that feedback that processing really is taking place. And now if you have to wait for the JVM to fully load and get to the point where it can pull that splash screen in and load it from Java code, that can take some time, several seconds can cause a noticeable pause for your end user. So what happened in Java 6 is that there's now a command line option that you can feed in directly that says, here's my splash screen file, load this guy up as soon as I try to start the JVM. And so that all happens in native code, and so it's very, very fast, and you get that really nice sort of instantaneous splash screen sign up to let you know that your application started. There's also better integration with the desktop just kind of across the board. So being able to interact with the system tray on the desktop, being able to interact with native desktop applications and things like browsers quite a bit easier. We also have in Java 6 some nice internationalization enhancements, support for building custom locales for doing better internationalization, particularly with internet domain names and URIs. So quite quite cool and useful stuff there in the specification in Java 6. Now, of course, our IBM SDK is fully 100% compliant with the Java specification. So all of the stuff that we've talked about so far has been your spec level stuff. So any Java 6 JVM would support these technologies. Now, as we move forward to slide 7, the things that we're going to be talking about are really IBM-specific technologies that are focused on our runtime environment. So the first thing that I want to touch on is shared classes and sort of our motivation for that and why we have moved in this direction of shared classes. So if we look at the diagram here on slide 7, both of the JVMs here are running on a single system, accessing real physical memory on one box. And when you look at the different things that are there, and you think about what's actually located in memory, there's a lot of class data that is taking up space in your Java heap. And a lot of that class data is static. It doesn't change. It's a part of that class file definition. And there's really no reason that it needs to be duplicated across all of the JVMs that are running on your system. If it's the same version of the class, it can be shared across all of the JVMs that are using that particular version of the class. And so here, we have highlighted those class memory segments in system memory that there really is a lot of duplication going on there across these JVMs. So when we look at that, we think, hey, this duplication, we could maybe avoid that. We could potentially save some space by pulling that information out and storing it in a central location. And that's exactly what happened when we introduced the shared class cache in Java 5. So we can move forward to slide 8. So in Java 5, we introduced a technology called the shared class cache, which took all of that static class data and pulled it into a central location where it was stored in an area of shared memory on that system. And that static class data then could be shared by any JVM that was running on the box. So when the classes would get loaded, or when the class loader needs to find a class, first it's going to go look in the shared class cache. And then if it doesn't find it there, it'll go through and load those classes according to sort of normal, its normal path and normal class loading scheme. The really cool thing about this is that since we have a lot of this class data that's stored in shared memory, that once it's there in the cache, you don't have to go out and load it from disk. So class loading for those classes in the cache becomes substantially faster, right? Because it's hugely faster to be able to pull stuff in that's already resident in memory than to have to go out and load something off the disk. So you save a lot of time in class loading and can substantially substantially improve JVM startup time as a result of that. Because as you're starting up your JVM, obviously you have to pull in a ton of classes and load just a bunch of classes. So if we can have some of those already in memory, we just save a lot of startup time. Also, if you have multiple JVMs running on a single box, which in a server environment where this is targeted, it's very likely that you would have multiple JVMs running on that box. So, you know, the more JVMs you have running, the more memory savings that you'll get across those JVMs, because the class data is stored in a central location, stored in the cache, and that's the only place it has to live. So, I see several questions and a lot of discussion going on about this in the group chat in the e-meeting, and I think that some of those questions will work a lot better if we are able to sort of discuss them interactively, and our plan for today is to go ahead and do that in the end. And Steve, I see you're addressing a lot of those questions, and that's awesome. Thank you for doing that. And if we still have things that we want to address about the shared data cache, we'll go ahead and do that at the end in the question and answer time. Okay, so we have a shared cache. We introduced it in Java 5. You get substantial memory savings. If you have multiple JVMs running on the box, you get significant startup speed improvements. One of the sort of caveats about this shared data cache in Java 5 is that it was able to persist beyond the lifetime of a JVM. So even if all of your JVMs on the box were down, you would still have this shared cache in shared memory on the system. But once you restart the box, once you shut down the system, the shared cache is going to disappear because it's just in memory. So anything that's in memory, you restart your box, the data goes away. And so an interesting thing that happens is that the first time you would start a JVM after system restart, it takes a little bit longer because that first time it's loaded, it's going through and identifying classes and populating the shared cache. So there was a slightly different performance characteristic the first time that you're doing anything with a JVM after you restart your system than you would see any other time in your when you're starting JVMs. So that is how it works in Java 5. And if we move on to slide 9, we can see some of the enhancements that happened in Java 6. So one of the key things that was introduced in the Java 6 release, this idea of shared cache persistence. So now we have the option of actually writing that shared cache off to a memory mapped file. So you can persist that data, and then you won't see that difference in startup time after system restart if you have persistence enabled. And if you're running with the shared cache on any of the OS levels that support persistence, that persistence is going to be enabled by default. But you can control it with command line options. You can turn it off if you don't want it there on those command line options are shown here on slide 9. Another hugely cool feature that was added to the shared data cache in this release in Java 6 is being able to not only store static class data, but also to be able to store some compiled code into the shared cache. So there are the JVM tries to heuristically identify methods that are used during JVM startup, and it takes those methods and it stores a compiled version of those into the shared data cache. And just like anything that gets stored in the shared data cache, it's automatically updated. So if the methods do get recompiled, the version in the shared cache will be updated. or we won't use the stale, we won't use the stale classes, and or the stale methods. So that updating and keeping everything up to date does happen automatically in the cache. So the fantastic thing about this method, being able to store compiled methods, is that, again, when you're starting up a JVM, obviously, you know, we talked about having to load in a ton of classes, but also you're going to be JIT compiling just a ton of methods, right? And so if we can take a bunch of those startup methods, get them pre-compiled, have that pre-compiled code stored out here in the cache, then we can save a ton of JVM startup time that we would have had to spend, you know, doing the JIT compilation on those methods. So we can see some substantial JVM startup time improvements, again, as a result of enhancing the cache with this code, being able to store compiled code. As with any new feature, or really any feature in the JVM, there are going to be, you know, command line options that you can control, you know, how the cache behaves, how the compiled code gets stored, and all that stuff. So there's an example here on slide 9 of that. And again, if you have the shared cache enabled in your JVM, this storing AOT ahead of time compiled code is going to be happening by default. So let's move to slide 10 and get sort of an idea of what the benefits are that we might see if we enable this technology. So the purple bar is no shared class technology being enabled. The pink bar represents what would happen if we had the shared classes technology that was available in Java 5. So what happens if we're running with that shared class technology enabled? And then the yellow bar represents what happens if we're running with the Java 6 shared class cache, where we have this additional improvement of being able to cache compiled code as well and use that to help improve our startup time. So if you look at the Webster application server example, which is the one on the far right, the startup time for the server shrinks from just about 25 seconds with no data sharing enabled to around 17 seconds with the Java 6 shared cache technology enabled. So we see a savings of around 25 to 30% in your startup time just by you know, flipping that switch and turning the shared data cache on. So very, very cool technology, very, very powerful. You can see a lot of goodness happen if you choose to enable shared classes. And again, I don't want you to think that we're ignoring your questions about the cache. You know, I see there's a lot of interest in this, and we can definitely address that later on in our question and answer time on the phone. Let's go ahead and move forward to slide 11 and begin talking about the just-in-time compiler. The JIT compiler is the compiler that does the ahead-of-time compilation for the shared data cache. So the JIT is kind of, you know, busy in this release, doing a lot of new pretty cool things. So that ahead of time compiled code that we talked about in reference to the shared data cache is being handled by the just-in-time compiler components. Another new feature in the JIT this release is something called dynamic loop transfer. And if you had used previous versions of the IBM SDK, like in Java 1.4.2, there was a technology there called NMI to JIT, which essentially was responsible for moving methods from the interpreter and transferring them over to the compiler. And this is sort of a reincarnation of that similar technology. It's not using the same code base, It's been implemented quite differently, but it does a similar kind of thing. So, you know, if you're familiar with that MMI to JIT, you can think of this along those terms. So sometimes, you know, a method will end up being sort of caught in a looping construct, you know, inside some for loop or while loop or whatever it is, and that's happening in the interpreter. And as we know, interpreted code is quite a bit slower than compiled code. And before, if you were looping in that interpreted method, you just had to continue looping there, and there was not a good way to fix that and improve the performance in Java 5. But now in Java 6, with this dynamic loop transfer functionality, the JIT compiler can go through and identify those candidate methods that are looping in the interpreter and go ahead and move those over dynamically to the compiler at runtime so that the methods can be compiled and you can get some better performance from running those compiled methods rather than running the interpreted methods. Currently, there is not a way to selectively disable dynamic loop transfer for particular methods, you know, like you can with JIT compilation, but you can turn the whole thing off. So if you think you've run into a problem with dynamic loop transfer and you're not sure what's going on, you can go ahead and hit the XJIT disable dynamic loop transfer flag, and it'll turn that off for you in your JVM. Also, every time we have a JVM release, we have a lot of focus on, you know, we want to support IBM's latest hardware and add special enhancements for you know, taking full advantage of new IBM processors that are available. So a lot of work went into Power 6 support and updated System Z support here in the Java 6 release as well. One thing that I want to also be sure to highlight about the JIT compiler is that, and I mentioned we have kind of this, you know, just-in-time compiler and also the AOT, or the ahead-of-time compiler. And if you are doing problem determination with compiled code, there are some subtle differences in how you do that with the JIT compiler, which if you've done JIT problem determination, you know, that's very very standard. That has not changed really in Java 6. But for the ahead-of-time compiled code, you know, if you're trying to debug issues there, there are some special things that you'll want to take into consideration. And it's sort of a broad topic, and I'm not going to go into a ton of problem determination detail here in this talk today. But I would encourage you, if you happen to be working through a compiled code problem, to just go out and consult the Java 6 Diagnostics Guide. And there is a link to it in the end of this presentation in the references. And it has a lot of great information, very detailed, about how to do problem determination, how specifically to deal with ahead-of-time compiled code versus just-in-time compiled code. So a great reference in that diagnostics guide. So let's go ahead and shift gears again on slide 12 and say a little bit about garbage collection. In Java 6, there are a few key sort of memory management changes. First, just class loading speeds in the garbage collector. Substantial improvements in class loading and unloading speed. And also some important changes in the generational concurrent garbage collection policy, which is a GC policy that was introduced in Java 5 that runs on the premise of trying to collect young objects first. So sort of the longer an object has been around in the Java heap, the more likely it is that we're going to continue to need it. So it really focuses on those new objects, on the young objects, when it's collecting garbage. So some important enhancements here in the GC policy that improve its performance and that also make the defaults just a little bit better and more user-friendly. So there used to be a 64 meg cap on the size, the default size for that young object space or the nursery space. And that cap has actually been removed now, and it's dynamically configured to be a percentage of your total heap size, which if you're running with a very large heap, you know, several gigabytes of heap space, and then you have, you know, a hard limit of 64 meg imposed for your nursery size, that's not ideal in most cases. So that's been changed to a percentage-based scheme. Now, with the hierarchical scanning, one of the great things about the garbage collection policy Gen Con is that the way that objects get copied around and moved from nursery space to tenured space does there's a lot of work that happens that improves the locality of objects. So if you are, you know, if you have objects that are related in sort of an inheritance parent-child relationship or that reference each other in some way, that those objects end up getting scrunched closer together in the heap space just based on how Gen Con works. So having more locality within those objects that are related to each other improves the speed of just your runtime environment, because if they're close together, it's easier to access each other. And also it compresses the heap space down, so there aren't as many holes. Things get shoved down close to each other. And the performance of the garbage collector is also greatly improved as a result of that. As far as, you know, real in-depth details on how hierarchical scanning works, it's a very in-depth technical topic, and there's a research paper available that actually describes in a ton of detail how that works. And so if that is a big interest, it's easy to go and grab the reference for that and provide this to you. You guys can kind of dig in and see how that works. In response to that, so if you have a parent-child relationship and the nursery is full, will you move to tenured space? The objects will continue to get moved to the tenured space when the nursery is full, regardless of that relationship. It won't change that. It won't change how that works. So in the garbage collector and memory management space, there are a lot of changes going on in the Gen Con policy. And also, if we move to slide 13, there's this new concept of compressed references that's been introduced in Java 6, which is a big change in how memory management can work. A couple of caveats here right now with what we're going to be talking about with compressed references. Some of the implementation details of this functionality could change somewhat before the next service refresh of Java 6. So the compressed references implementation right now is not 100% complete. The compressed references implementation that was included as a part of the SR1 refresh for Java 6, it includes a partial implementation, but not this full implementation. So there are a couple of things that I'm going to be talking about that are not supported yet, but that are planned for future service refresh. So I'll highlight that as we're going through. So the idea of compressed references is that when you move to a 64-bit JDK that you obviously would typically be using, you know, 64-bit pointers and 64-bit object references on a 64-bit platform. So if you move from a 32-bit platform to a 64-bit platform, your heap usage on your box, your memory usage, I mean, the footprint goes up substantially, right? And if you are a person who's, you know, you're running on a 32-bit platform, say you're running on Windows, and you really want to be able to have, you need about 3 gigabytes of heap space for your application. You can't do that with a 32-bit JVM on Windows. And so really our only solution for you is to go ahead and move up to a 64-bit platform if you need that space. But when you move up to that 64-bit platform, your JVM is also going to grow quite a bit. And so we wanted to try to take some steps to target those users who have somewhat limited heap requirements, but who need to move to a 64-bit platform so that we can sort of minimize that burden of that, you know, pointer explosion and having a lot of extra space in your Java, you know, memory space being taken up by pointers. Because when we think about objects, when we think about the Java heap, a ton of it is just object references and pointers. So what we've done in Java 6 is added the capability on 64-bit platforms to use 32-bit heap offsets to reference heap data. And that's currently, it is just 32-bit heap offsets. So if you're using the SR1 version of the JVM, there is a limit of 4 gigabyte heap space for using compressed references on these 64-bit platforms. And later, in later iterations, we'll be expanding that up to around 32 gigabytes of heap space using a sliding scale of compressed references to make that possible. So essentially you can move to a 64-bit platform, and if you have relatively limited heap requirements, you can make that move to the 64-bit platform but not have sort of the heap explosion that you might be expecting or had been accustomed to in the past. But you still do get sort of the you still get the throughput benefits of running on that 64-bit platform. So this is a very cool thing. The other nice thing about this idea of compressed references is that, you know, it improves what we think of or what we classify as efficiency. And so if we move to slide 14, it's a little bit easier to see what that means. So in the with the 32-bit objects, 24 bytes there are used as the actual you know, pointer information. In a 64-bit object, that is typically 48 bytes. So we use that 24 bytes sort of as our, you know, benchmark reference. You know, that is 100% efficiency because we're not, you know, wasting any additional space. And so we consider the 48-byte object pointers in the 64-bit object to be, you know, half as efficient because it's using, you know, twice as much space to essentially do the same thing. So the goal then in the 64-bit compressed references implementation is to, if you're using a 4-gigabyte heap, to be able to improve that efficiency and bring it back up to 100%. And as we move through future iterations of the JVM implementation, we hope to expand that upper bound of heap space available to about 32 gigs. So currently it's 4. The intent is to use scaling to bump that up to 32 gigs in an upcoming release. And on slide 15 is sort of a nice summary of some of the benefits that you'll see with compressed references. So if we could move to slide 15. So you have access to more heap space than you would have had on a 32-bit environment, but you also get smaller heap sizes than you would on a typical 64-bit environment. And you'll get your throughput improvements that you would normally see on a 64-bit platform because you do still have access to those 64-bit processors with 64-bit registers. You know, the JIT can take full advantage of those. And overall, the heap utilization is better. We have more efficient heap utilization. Okay, so I think that's enough to say about compressed references and the runtime environment in general. And so next what I want to do is focused some on problem determination and serviceability tools. And so the first thing that we're going to look at here is forward on slide, looks like 17. And I apologize again, slide 17, when we uploaded the slides to the e-meeting, things got stretched out a little bit, so this spills across the screen. But if you look in the PDF file, it's lined up like it should be and a little bit easier to read. So, native stack traces. In Java 6, we've introduced some new native stack traces that you'll see in console dumps and that you'll also see in your Java cores or your thread dump files for some failures. So the native stack traces contain information about what was going on in the failing native thread, including the library that was being referenced and pointer information about the instruction that was also being referenced. So the key thing here for you guys to understand about these native stack traces is that it's hugely useful problem determination for us here at IBM as we're trying to work through helping you solve your problems. So if you do have a crash, if you have some problem that you're reporting to IBM service, please do include this new native failing thread information because it's just extremely useful as we work to to solve those problems. On slide 18, I've summarized a few things that have changed with heap dump processing in this release. And the key things here are compression and performance in producing these heap dumps. So with binary heap dumps, which are the default portable heap dump format, with those binary heap dumps, we've taken advantage of some information in the file format specification for those binary heap dumps and introduced some compression. Particularly on 64-bit platforms, you'll probably notice an improvement here compared to Java 5. So the idea is that these binary heap dump files can be quite a bit smaller in this release, particularly on 64-bit platforms. And partly as a result of that compression, it's also we've also improved the speed of just dumping those files and generating them. So since the files are smaller, obviously it doesn't take as long to write them to disk. We've also introduced some caching so that we don't have to cross those native I/O boundaries as often, which has also boosted the performance quite a bit of writing out these files to disk. And in some cases, you might see that it's up to 10 times faster to write these heap dumps out than it was in the previous release. So very cool. You got smaller heap dumps, and they'll be produced faster by the JVM. In the Java 5 JVM, the default behavior for producing a heap dump was to go ahead and do that when there was an out-of-memory error that was uncaught. So any uncaught out-of-memory error event would produce a heap dump by default. Now in Java 6, there's a new systhrow dump event that's been introduced, and we use that systhrow dump event to control when the heap dumps are going to get generated. So systhrow just indicates some event or error that is thrown by the JVM itself. So any out-of-memory error event that comes from us within the JVM is going to go ahead and produce that out-of-memory error by default. So if you go in and look at the default dump settings, you'll see that this new systhrow dump event is being used. And that also was backported to the Java 5 release as well in one of the later service refreshes for Java 5. Let's keep moving forward to slide 19. So one of the other things that we really focus on here at IBM is trying to come up with good ways and consistent ways to be able to develop tools for doing problem determination on the JVM. So the key way that we have chosen to do that is by introducing something called the Diagnostic Tool Framework for Java, which is an API that's used to build diagnostic tools for Java programs. And so this isn't a new set of APIs in Java 6, but it has been enhanced some in this release. So previously, you could only process system dumps or core files with the DTFJ, but now you can also send in Java dumps or your thread dumps or your Java core, whatever you choose to call it, and we can process those with the DTFJ as well. So that's pretty cool. And the real benefit of having access to this diagnostic tool framework is that it allows people to sort of do dump introspection and write tools without really having to understand or know anything about the actual dump structure. So it provides just a really nice layer of abstraction for people who want to be writing these tools, and also sort of insulates you from changes between releases. So we work hard to try to maintain the level of API that we expose to you, and that gives us the freedom then to be able to sort of muck with our internal file formats or change things that we need to change without breaking you or any of the tools that you might write. So you can use the DTFJ to access essentially any information that you can think of that would be stored in a thread dump or in a core dump, you can access with the DTFJ APIs. So anything about your Java classes and Java objects, where stuff is in memory, how it's related, and information also about the system that you're running on, the JVM level that was being used, what's going on with your threads, your Java threads, your native threads, all that kind of stuff, you can access programmatically with the DTFJ. There are, in the diagnostics guide, again, the reference for that's at the end of this presentation, contains fully functional code examples of how this actually works so that you can see that and use that as a base if you're interested in looking at this and using this. In slide 20, there's a partial class diagram that illustrates what some of these constructs are in the DTFJ. So if you're using the DTFJ and you start up on the left side on the with the orange classes, you feed in your image, so your core dump file. You feed that image in to the API, and it and sort of walk through and pull out information about the process. And finally, you'll get down to the managed runtime layer. And that managed runtime layer is the bridge between the actual image dump file itself and then being able to access all of the information that was stored in that dump. So in that managed runtime, you can pull out the Java runtime object, and from there it just fans out to any of the data that you want to pull. So that you'll see that the classes and fields and methods, the threads and the objects, all of that stuff that you typically think of being available in your dump files, you can pull out using this DTFJ technology. So a nice way to abstract those dumps out and make it much simpler to develop those tools. And there are great examples of this in the diagnostics guide. There's also full Java doc available. It's packaged with the SDK documentation. So those are some of the changes in the serviceability components that are packaged as a part of the SDK. As we move on to slide 21, I'll be talking a little bit about serviceability tools that are available externally to the JVM itself. And one of those areas is the IBM Support Assistant, which is a graphical tool that you would typically run on your on a workstation or in a development environment, and you can customize the interface with add-ons for a variety of different IBM software tools and products, and you can pull in and add problem determination tools. You can add links to documentation. You can use the tool to electronically access your service requests and your PMRs with IBM. It's just a really nice environment to be able to access a broad range of problem determination tools. And on slide 22, I've highlighted a few of the different tools that are available for doing Java problem determination. The dump analyzer is focused on processing core files or system dumps. And the memory dump diagnostic tool for Java is focused on doing heap dump analysis and analyzing memory leaks. And then the garbage collection and memory visualizer is focused on processing verbose GC output and helping you to figure out what's going on in your Java heap and also to address some memory problems. And it, again, we don't have a whole lot of time here to jump into the details of really how a lot of these tools work. But I do want you to be aware that they're out there, they're available in IBM Support Assistant, which is a free tool, and all of these tools also are available at no charge. So it's a great set of tools. And on slide 23, you can see we've recently released, in the last couple of months, an updated version of the Support Assistant Workbench, which is IBM Support Assistant version 4. And a couple of key things that are new in the Support Assistant version 4 that I wanted to highlight. First, they've added some agent functionality that allows you to configure Support Assistant agents on like your production level boxes or places where you're actually running Java or you're actually running WebSphere application server. And then you can connect to those agents from your Support Assistant workbench and do remote debugging, do remote problem determination. It's a very very powerful interface. And particularly related to WebSphere Application Server, there are some really cool JVM-related problem determination tasks that are available. You can remotely trigger different kinds of dumps and also enable and collect verbose GC output. So you can think of it like if you have a WebSphere Application Server running on one box, you're working on your development workstation, you want to be able to get a Java core file from that WAS JVM and bring it down to your workstation to analyze. There are really nice sort of click-through tools in the Support Assistant Workbench that will automatically just take care of all of that for you. So you tell it what you want it to do, and then it goes out to your remote system, forces it to generate that Java core file, and then pulls that Java core file back to your workstation so you can do the analysis. I think that's so cool and very powerful and helpful in doing problem determination. Let's go ahead and jump forward to slide 25 because I want to look briefly at one of the problem determination tools that that I've mentioned called the Garbage Collection and Memory Visualizer, which is it's not new for Java 6, but was sort of released and introduced during the Java 6 development cycle. So it's a relatively new tool, and I just want to highlight that for you and make you all aware that it's available and kind of what it does. So the GCMV is designed to handle verbose garbage collection output and provide really useful visualizations of a really broad range of GC data characteristics. So, heap usage, what are your pause times like, what's your throughput like, There are over 40 different GC data characteristics available in the tool. So pretty much anything that you can think of that you would want to monitor or graph or see a representation of, the tool can show you. So in addition to being able to look at those visualizations, the tool also provides very useful tuning recommendations for working with your Java heap and changing your GC settings to improve your performance. And on slide 26 is an example of what the interface looks like. So here I've pulled in three different runs of a particular application, and you can read all three of those verbose GC log files and end up comparing them here together on a single graph, so you can see how they're related to each other. So if you wanted to do something like you're not sure which GC policy you want to use, well, you can try opt average pause, you can try opt throughput, you can try Gen Con, and you can bring all three of those verbose GC logs in and plot them out here and look at the different GC data characteristics and see how it's working to help you make that decision of what the right settings are for you. In addition to being able to just do the visualization, the reports and recommendations are extremely useful. And I'd like to skip forward actually to slide 28, which contains a detailed example of what the recommendations themselves look like. So if you've enabled reporting and enabled providing tuning recommendations, then you can go into your report in the GCMV tool, and it will tell you really some very specific and very helpful recommendations for improving your configuration and improving your performance. So here I was running with the generational concurrent GC policy, and it's giving me information about how my nursery is behaving and how my tenured area is behaving. In this case, my heap usage was growing over time, so my heap kept expanding. So it wants to call that out to me and let me know some things that I could do to my application and to look at to help to understand why my memory usage is increasing over time. And in some cases, depending on your environment and what's happening, it will actually provide specific command line options that you can add and test out in your environment as well. So I think that this is so powerful, and that you can get just a lot of goodness out of using some of these tools, in particular this garbage collection and memory visualizer, to help you improve the performance of your environment and to help you understand what's going on with your garbage collection. So I encourage you to go out there and grab it and see how it works for you. Now, let's move forward to slide, a couple slides to slide 30, the next content slide. And I want to say a few brief words about some things that you might see as you're moving to Java 6. So, what are some of the gotchas? What are some of the things that have changed that you could hit? And the majority of these things are direct results of changes in the specification itself. So typically what we'll say is that, class files that have been compiled at the previous JDK levels at 1.4.2 or at Java 5 will continue to run in the Java 6 runtime, but there are a few incompatibilities. And some additional details on incompatibilities are available on the SUM website, where they talk about all of the compatibility issues between the different levels of the specification. We've talked already about the new class file format, and so if you do bytecode verification or bytecode manipulation of any kind, that's something that you'll need to pay attention to. Also, in this release, JVMDI JVMDI and JVMPI were deprecated in the previous release, and now JVMDI has actually been removed, and JVMPI has been disabled. So the direction here for doing tooling and writing debugging tools is to use the new JVMTI set of APIs instead. There are also some enhancements in the compiler and the way that it handles casting, particularly related to generics. So, again, another change, if you compile the same class files using the Java 5 Java C compiler and the Java 6 Java C compiler, there is a potential that in some cases you'll see different results. Slide 31, continue with some of the incompatibilities that have been showing up. In the IBM JVM packages, there are some slight packaging changes. Some folks choose to directly reference some of the SDK libraries themselves, and libjvm.so is commonly, that commonly happens with that particular shared library, so the location of that guy has changed. So just be aware of that if you're needing to reference that library, it's in a new place. And also just, the locations of jar files and the exact jar files that are packaged with the SDK have changed. In Java 6, there are many more classes that are incorporating a lot of the core technologies that were introduced in Java 5, in particular, generics. And so if one example where we ran into this as we were working with the application server is with this object name class, which used to take just a hash table object in its constructor, but now it takes a generified hash table object of string types. So in this case, you used to be able to pass in an actual properties object to the constructor in Java 5, but since now the properties object extends a hash table, but it extends like an object hash table and not a string hash table, this pass no longer works because of the way that the generics have changed and the different parameters. So this is a potential sort of incompatibility that you might see at compile time based on changes in the way that the class libraries themselves have been incorporating generics in this release. Slide 32. For translates, which are pre-compiled XSLTs, they're dependent on the XML libraries that were used to compile them. So since we have updated our XSLT processor in Java 6, those guys do need to be recompiled with the new SDK to be able to continue to use them. The Apache Xalin library and implementation is still available. It is still there and packaged, and you can explicitly call that, but by default you'll be using the new IBM implementation. The XSLTs do need to be recompiled. There are also some new interfaces that have been added here, particularly the Q and the double-ended Q interfaces. And often what people would do in previous releases would be to take the linked list class and extend it and add some methods to it to turn it into a Q. But now the linked list class actually implements this new Q interface. So it has its own like push and pop methods inside. So if you've created your own queue based on linked list, you could run into some compile time issues because the methods that you've added no longer make sense, and linked list actually implements its own queue and has that functionality inside it. So you can go ahead and use the actual linked list queue implementation instead. Also, there have been some classes that have been removed from the base SDK package. So with swing look and feel classes, previously all of the available look and feel classes were packaged for every platform. And in Java 6, only the look and feel classes that apply to a particular platform are now packaged with that platform. So if for some reason you had directly referenced a look and feel class from some other platform, that could be a problem for you because those classes are no longer available and packaged with the SDK by default. Okay, so let's go ahead and just jump to slide 34. So we've been through an awful lot so far here in the last hour or so. We spent most of our time just talking about the runtime environment itself, the class libraries, and the runtime components of the IBM SDK, including things like the shared class cache, which I'm happy to address your questions on here in just a moment. Also, serviceability components and tools, some that are embedded in the JDK, some that are available as standalone tools, and then also addressed a few common incompatibility issues that folks have seen when migrating to Java 6 from previous releases. So, Elijah, I believe that's everything I wanted to go through. I'll hand it back to you to do your thing.
Thank you, Vanessa, for a great presentation.
We'll hear first from Herman Huber with IBM.
Hello, good afternoon. First of all, thanks for the great presentation. Actually, I have two questions here, namely, first question would be related to the shared class cache. The shared class cache seems to be that the classes are loaded to the shared area only, and then from the process space of the JVM is pointed to the shared class cache area. Is this correct?
I think the way that you said it there, I would say no, that's not correct. I mean, the shared classes are not only loaded or always loaded to the shared data area. The shared data area is obviously quite limited in size. We don't want it to get out of hand. So it's possible that it would fill up, and when it fills up, then the classes that are being loaded would not be put there. They would just be loaded normally, stored in your normal Java heap space.
That's of course, if the shared class cache is full, of course the classes get loaded to the process memory area. But as long as there's space or old classes which are loaded to the shared class cache area, they also get access from the JVM directly from there, and the class code is not copied to the process memory space.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Wonderful. Thanks. The second one is, do you know if this is the default behavior of website that website uses these class caches, or do we have to enable this feature manually?
That is an excellent question, and I am not sure.
Okay. No problem.
Yeah, I am not sure. But it is something that I can check, and I don't know. Elijah, you can maybe help me afterwards if there's a way for me to post additional follow-up to questions somewhere, but
okay.
We can work that out.
Why are compressed references are disabled by default?
Why are they disabled by default?
Yeah, because it seems to be a nice feature, which allows me to use larger heaps with less overhead. So why are they disabled by default? What's the gotcha with it?
So the formal answer to that is probably fairly complicated. So a couple of things that I'll highlight for you just now. So currently in the SR1 implementation that's out there, they are disabled by default. But in SR2, if all goes according to plan, which, again, I'm very hesitant to talk about future plans in a context like this because that's always subject to change. But the intention there is that it would actually be enabled by default. Certainly, if not in the base JDK, certainly for the application server. So it's always a struggle to try to figure out when is a good time to change default options, because a lot of the time users are concerned or upset or frustrated when we change our default behaviors. And so we take that very seriously, and we try to evaluate it the best that we can and do the right thing. And often we will err on the side of safety and not changing it and just trying to make people aware that it's an option they can turn on. So.
Okay, I can understand this, but I just was wondering if this is a new feature in Java 6. But thanks for your answers and your presentation again.
Do we have other questions queued up, Heather?
As a reminder to everyone on the phone line, that is star 1 if you'd like to ask a question. And we'll hear next from Tomas Mozalewski with Citi.
Hello. My question is about the classes that are being shared between JVMs, the common cache. How does the JDK determine what version of the class is being used or when the class needs to be refreshed or two different instances need to be cached?
So we would not cache two instances of the same class in the same cache. And the classes that are stored in the cache get updated when they are recompiled.
Okay, so for instance, if I have two different application running on two different JDKs, and then I decide to put a new version of that application on one of those JDKs. What needs to happen for the JDK to determine that one class is a different version than the other?
I'm trying to think of the best way. So you have, when you talk about different versions of the application, what do you mean exactly?
For instance, I wrote a class and I started it up on JDK on the server. Then I decided to modify that class. Let's say I made a mistake, so I corrected the mistake and then I started the second instance of the JVM on the same machine. Will that second instance use the cached class from the first instance, or is it going to load the new class I just updated?
It will load the new class that you just updated.
And how will it determine the difference?
Because when you updated the class, it got it will get refreshed in the cache.
Well, yes, but
so,
it's the same cache, and you say it only has one instance of the class, so now the other JDK will refresh that class also?
Are you talking about an environment where you're running different, like, JDK levels?
No, I'm running the same JDK level. It's just I'm running two JVMs. I started one with a version of the class at one time, and then I started another JVM with updated version of the class.
The recompiled version of the class would be the one that gets stored in the shared cache and would be the one that would get accessed by both of the JVMs.
Okay, what if those two classes are in two separate jar files?
Do they have the same name and the same
class name, location and everything is exactly the same. It's just I have one jar with one version of the class and a different jar with a different version of the class. The jars are named the same way,
right,
but they're put in different directories. Let's put it this way.
I cannot tell you for sure. I don't know exactly what's going to happen if you do that. So what I will say, though, is if you, if you do have an environment where you want to be using the different jar files in the different JVMs, if your class path is configured to not include them both, right? You'll load the one you want always.
What I'm saying is I will load the one I want, but you said that the cache is now shared between JVMs. Because one JVM will point to one jar file, the other JVM will point to the other jar file, but the cache between those two JVMs, you said it's only going to hold one instance of the class. So which instance will be held in the cache?
I honestly don't know which one it will be. I don't know if it will be the first one or the second one. One other, if you're concerned about like overlapping classes and need to have more isolated environments.
That's the whole point. I mean, to isolate environments, we run them on different JVMs, but then again, to save money, we run all those JVMs on one machine.
One thing that you also could consider doing is you can have, you know, multiple instances of a cache on a particular system. So when you're starting your JVM, you can tell it, you know, I want you to connect to this particular cache that I've configured to use all of these classes for this particular version of the application. And so, and if you have a lot of versioning, that would mean that you aren't using the same classes across those JVMs. So there's no, you're not getting that thing sharing benefit that really you would want to be getting. So you might as well, have a cache that you've identified for each one that.
But that's the whole point. I mean,
but you would still get the.
I mean, the whole point is that I have a lot of classes which are the same between all those JVMs because I'm using a lot of third-party jar files. So the same jar files, the same classes get used all over the place. But the custom application we develop is fairly small in comparison to everything else. So that cache would be a perfect solution for us because the most of the things that don't change would be held only once instead of 10 times on each machine.
So the other thing that you could do or consider doing, mm-hmm. You can control, if there are classes for your applications that you don't want to ever get loaded into the shared cache, you can, restrict the construction of the cache. And say, we don't want you to put these classes out there and try to get it, to focus on those third-party libraries that you're most concerned about having available to share.
All right. I think that's going to work. So basically you can specify on the package level which classes not to load in the cache?
I'd have to check the documentation. I don't remember the syntax or how you specify it.
All right. I'll look it up. Thank you.
Excellent. Excellent questions so far. Thanks. And I did see, showing up in the evening, Herman came back to say that he did look at the shared class cache information and that WAS 6.1 does use it and enable it by default. So thank you for checking that so quickly.
And as a final reminder, ladies and gentlemen, that is *1 on your touchtone telephone if you would like to ask a question. And we'll hear next from Arman Chatterjee with eBay.
Hi. My question is that who loads this cache into the shared memory, and if there is any bound on it, how basically do you configure it so that it does not get out of control?
So that it doesn't take over the world.
Yeah.
The JVM is responsible for monitoring and loading and removing and updating classes from the cache, and you configure the whole thing using command line options to the JVM. So there's a big family of -XSC options or -X shared classes options. I think there's some of each. That allow you to configure what you want the cap to be, how large you'll allow your cache to grow, and when you want it to disappear and how you want. I mean, you can display all sorts of characteristics of it. You can sort of mug with it to your heart's content using all the different command line options.
And is this a LRU-style cache, or, is it like the class loader cache that we usually write when we write class loaders?
I didn't understand the very first part of your question.
So I'm just wondering if it's a, like, you know, least recent used kind of an implementation. I mean, where you have an X amount of, let's say, you have 10 meg of memory, and you know, you load like 10,000 classes in there, and you know, next one, if you want to cache it, then one drops off or something like that.
The
oldest one drops off or whatever.
No, and that is not how it works.
Okay.
It's once it's full, it's full. So. We don't purge the older classes.
Okay.
And you can't, like, if you're using a custom class loader, there are APIs that you can interact with the cache and still use
okay.
it in your custom class loader.
All right. And could you please share that document that you talked about on this class
that,
loader?
Like hierarchical scanning white paper, is that? The one you're referring to?
I think you mentioned, like, when we were discussing this on the in the group chat, you mentioned some kind of a document about this class loader, I mean, about this cache that you have.
You know, I wasn't actually referring to the shared cache. I was referring to the garbage collection functionality with... And in particular, the hierarchical scanning that was added for
okay.
Gen Con in 6.1. But, you know, I think it would probably not be very difficult to find. I know we do have references for shared classes in addition to the things that you would already see. Like if you look in the SDK user guides and if you look in the diagnostics guide, there is going to be stuff out there that's really useful to help sort of get your head around shared classes and all the stuff you can do and configure. But we have some other just papers and articles, I believe. And if Elijah will permit me, I will find those and add them to the references of the presentation so that those can be uploaded to the website as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Sure.
We have no further questions at this time.
All right, at this time, we conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on the site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Vanessa, for presenting today.